Okay, good afternoon, everybody. We're going to try to start the session on time. I wanted to welcome you to the special session called Moving from Promises to Action, Building Global and National Commitment for Evidence-Based Approaches to Addressing Stigma and Discrimination. I am Paul Purcell, Director of HIV-STA Programs at Engender Health. I am very glad to be co-chairing the session today along with Susan Timberlake, Senior Human Rights and Law Advisor with the UNAIDS Secretariat. It is a subject that I think about often and is very close to my heart, both personally as a gay man and professionally because Engender Health was an early pioneer of addressing stigma and discrimination at the health facility level, and it continues to be an integral part of all of our HIV programming. I wanted to first introduce the session, and then Susan is going to end the session with some closing remarks. In introducing the session, I wanted to start with some good news. There is evidence that stigma reduction approaches are working, and proven tools and resources are now available that can be combined to affect change at individual, community, and policy levels. But despite this, stigma and discrimination continues to fuel the HIV/AIDS epidemic throughout the world. And in recent years, we've also started seeing the emergence of other key populations vulnerable for HIV, including married women, which is an interplay between stigma and gender. I think we should be concerned that despite this evidence, efforts to address stigma's negative impact still remain grossly neglected in national and international AIDS responses. While many countries claim to include human rights and stigma reduction measures in their national strategies, stigma reduction interventions at the country level are more often than not fragmented, not being measured, of limited or questionable quality, and of too small a scale to achieve lasting impact. There has never been a more urgent time in the history of the epidemic to scale up effective approaches for addressing stigma and discrimination. At this point, I just wanted to highlight the fact that despite the increased availability of prevention, care, and treatment services worldwide, this does not necessarily equal access or an increased uptake to those services. If we are to achieve universal access, what we need is a stronger political will, both globally and nationally, to address this complex issue through an evidence-based, multifaceted, and adequately funded response. To further frame our thinking today, we have five remarkable speakers. Justin Edwin Cameron from South Africa will talk about, among other things, how all exceptional measures in respect of HIV and AIDS are themselves potentially stigmatizing. Then Anandi Uvaraj will talk about an innovative and important tool for measuring stigma. Next, Nora Nye Blade will talk about the existing evidence base regarding stigma reduction efforts through highlighting a well-evaluated program in Vietnam. Angela Pinto will then report on her program in Brazil as a positive example of national commitment and how to take a stigma reduction program to scale. And finally, Miriam Clausen will discuss some of the current challenges in getting funding for stigma reduction work and what we can do to overcome this. Following each presentation, we will take up to two questions. And after all the presentations, we will open the floor up for a moderated question and answer period. My co-chair, Susan, will now introduce the first set of speakers.
Okay, hello everyone. Very glad to see you here. Glad to see so many of you here. I have the great pleasure to introduce Edwin Cameron. We asked Edwin for a bio, which was a bit of a silly thing to do because we all know him very well, and he gave me one sentence. He is a justice of the Supreme Court of the Appeal of South Africa and the author of the memoir, Witness to AIDS. No, that's not enough. First of all, I'd like to say he's too young to have written a memoir. He needs to write another one. So we're waiting for that. And second of all, I'd like to say I believe, Edwin, and please correct me if I'm wrong, you are still the only high-level political official in all the continent of Africa who is public about your status. And I think that says more about stigma and discrimination than almost anything else we can say. It is an incredible indicator of the problem we're trying to deal with today. Okay, Edwin, please.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Susan, and thank you, Paul. It's a great pleasure. Ladies and gentlemen, how are you? Are you fine? Thank you. Have you had too many speeches already? Well, this is going to be a good session. Paul is a very strict chairman. He was very strict when he got us to send our presentations to him earlier. I was the only person who was late. And he sent me an email, CC'd to the whole list, that said, Edwin, I haven't seen your presentation yet. If you've already sent it, please tell me so that I can check my inbox again. Well, I'm going to use that line in future. But the point is, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to speak for only 10 minutes because the point of our session is that we want you to be involved as well. And I'm going to make us a couple of what I hope will be provocative points, and I'd like to hear what you have to say about them. The first point I want to make is quite a central point, which I think many of you will agree on. It's that stigma, I think, remains one of the fundamental obstacles to the rational management of this epidemic. We know what we have to do in the field of prevention. We know that AIDS is now a medically manageable disease. I've been on antiretrovirals for very nearly 11 years. I know that my life prospects, according to the Danish study, are equivalent to a person, a 55-year-old, well-nourished professional man who hasn't got HIV because my antiretrovirals are working. So we know what to do, but stigma stands in the way of our doing it. I was on the bus yesterday afternoon back to the hotel with a fellow country person of mine, a woman called Pam Picken, who runs a children's organization in Durban called Tree. And she said that they've lost 5 of their workers in the last year or two. These are people working for an organization in the AIDS field. One of the workers that Pam told me about has a sister who is a nursing sister working for an AIDS organization. Now, you ask me, why should adult, well-informed people in South Africa, where there's publicly provided treatment, in South Africa, having survived our president's long commitment to AIDS denialism, we now have the biggest publicly provided antiretroviral treatment program in the world. We've got more than 400,000 people on it, and it's growing. Why are people dying? And the answer is stigma. I want to expand this first point by making 3 observations about it. The direct effect of stigma is discrimination. Discrimination, especially in premature epidemics. I went to Colombo last year. I was told by people in the Asia and Pacific region that healthcare workers are still refusing to deal with sex workers or men who have sex with men who come into their facilities. So there's direct discrimination. Secondly, the burden of diagnosis is immensely heightened because of stigma. Stigma weighs down every person. If you have breast cancer or you have insulin-dependent diabetes, it's a burdensome health condition, but you don't carry stigma as well. A diagnosis of HIV carries this enormous burden of stigma with it as well. And then thirdly, there's the point that I made about Pam Picken's workers, that you have resistance to diagnosis and treatment because people are resisting stigma. So a terrific burden on the epidemic. My fellow speakers in this program are going to be expanding on many aspects of those. Let me move to my second point, which is the point that we know a great deal about the external manifestation of stigma, which is social ostracism, discrimination, rejection, violent assaults. In Africa, women who are diagnosed with HIV suffer violent assaults at the hands of their spouses or partners, exclusion from the community, sometimes death. We've studied that. We know how to deal with it. We at least know what we're campaigning against. But what we understand far less about is the internal dimension of stigma. It's the dimension of stigma that operates internally within the person who has HIV or is at risk of HIV. It's a dimension that I experienced myself, and I think it's one of the pivotal dimensions to understanding stigma. It's not the stigma we fight in the outside world. It's not the stigma we fight in those people who are enemies of rational treatment of HIV. It's the stigma that we fight inside ourselves and inside the people that we are trying to reach and cooperate with, and in the old paternalistic hierarchical language, trying to help in this epidemic. And we are trying to help them, but we are fighting the battle of the internal dimension of stigma. I was interested to see that there was a special edition of the journal AIDS, which was published together with this conference, and it had a special review section dealing with stigma. by Anish P. Mahajan and others. And it's a lengthy review article on stigma and on the conclusions from the evidence which has been assembled in all the learned medical and psychosocial articles on stigma. There's no mention in this review article of internal stigma. And I think that's an omission. I think it's a terrible error for a number of reasons. We need to acknowledge the working of internal stigma. It's the dimension of stigma that finds within the person with HIV or the person at risk of HIV, the person who fears an HIV diagnosis, who finds an ally within that person, which says within that person, yes, I am less worthy. I am contaminated. I am infected. I am unclean. I am impure. I am polluted in some sense. That's what I experienced with my own HIV diagnosis. I was working at a human rights institute at the University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg in South Africa. I was working with comrades who were all committed to a notion of human dignity and human equality under human rights law. I couldn't talk to them. Not so much because I feared their rejection, although I did also fear that. But I was unable to talk to them because I disentitled myself to their human connection, solidarity, and support. That's not to blame myself. It's not to blame people who suffer internal stigma, but we have to understand it. And I don't think that we're doing enough in this epidemic to understand that internal dimension. I don't think our researchers and doctors and social scientists are doing enough. I want to move to my last comment, which I hope will be provocative. I remember the last AIDS conference I attended was in 2002 in Barcelona. Who was there? Who was at the Barcelona conference? It was a great conference. Quite a few people who were there. And I spoke on testing. And 2002 was the year after President Festus Mogae of Botswana introduced opt-out testing in Botswana. He said that if you're a Botswana who goes to a public health clinic, and you come with symptomatic presentations of HIV, you're going to be tested for HIV unless you tell the doctor or the nurse no. Unless you say, I don't want to be tested, you're going to be given an HIV test. I supported that. And before I'd even finished, there were people lining up the corridors to come and speak in opposition to my suggestion that Botswana's approach to HIV testing was correct. Well, I think 6 years later that Botswana has been vindicated. We haven't yet won that battle within the HIV human rights community. It's a complex battle. UNAIDS has taken, I think, a very nuanced stance on provider-initiated testing. My friends and comrades in the Asia and Pacific region, where there's not a mass prevalence, not a mass epidemic, tell me that I'm wrong to say that you must have opt-out testing also in low prevalence, high-risk group settings. They say that there, it'll simply mean that men who have sex with men and commercial sex workers and injecting drug users will be subjected to more discrimination. I understand that. I'm talking about a high prevalence mass epidemic like we are suffering in South Africa and in Southern Africa, which is bearing the greatest burden of this epidemic. I'm saying that in that setting, not just with testing, we have got to consider the extent to which our special protections, our specializing, our exceptionalization of AIDS, to surround it with human rights protections, to make testing more difficult in order to protect people, isn't working with their internal dimension of stigma to stigmatize HIV. We've got to consider, the principle is this, ladies and gentlemen. Exceptional measures were justified and remain justified in this epidemic because of discrimination and stigma. We have got to consider the extent to which our exceptional measures reinforce stigma. I believe that a lot of the protections in place that make testing difficult for HIV reinforce stigma. We make it difficult for people to test, to choose testing, to choose healthful options instead of running away and saying, no, I don't want to be tested because that disease is too exceptional. The implications go beyond the pure testing area. It goes to what strategies we as people committed to normalization of this epidemic, because what we want is the normal treatment of HIV. It's treatment as an unexceptional disease. What stands between us and that is discrimination and stigma. We have to examine our own strategies, our own tactics, our own organizational agendas in relation to all we do and who we form alliances with to check that our own special protections don't enhance stigma. What we really are aiming for is to secure treatment for all. It's a battle against the disabling ignominy that many all too often feel. And the corollary of that is that we have to acknowledge that the principles against which we judge all our campaigns and all our strategies might fail those, and they might fail them by reinforcing stigma. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Edwin, for that very provocative talk. I believe it puts forward to us all the challenge of figuring out exactly how do we protect people in the context of HIV, and what do we mean by protection? Is protection access to treatment? Is protection from stigma and discrimination? Should there be an either or there? We're going to hear now, as we go through the panel, more about the actual programs that can reduce stigma and discrimination. Let me turn to our next speaker. Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Let's do take a couple of questions. Let's take two questions, and then we're going to open this up at the end for a full discussion. Yes, please.
Thanks very much. My name is Sven Robinson. I'm from Canada. And I just wanted to ask Edwin a question. But before I ask a question, to say that not only did Edwin display incredible courage in being open about his HIV status, but he was also openly gay in an incredibly courageous and inspirational way. And that's the basis of my question. I will be very brief. Edwin, you talked about the destructive impact of internal stigma. I wonder if you could just talk briefly about the impact of stigma of homophobia. Because I remember, and I was a member of homophobia, yes. I was an MP in Canada for many years. I came out publicly as a gay man, partly because of the reality that in the late 80s, when I came out, many of my gay friends were more afraid that people would discover that they were gay than that they were living with HIV or that they had AIDS. This is a huge problem, obviously, in Africa, where, again, you're almost alone in being openly gay when we've got government leaders who are condemning gay people in dehumanizing and degrading terms. Religious leaders like the Mufti of Uganda, who called recently for all gays in Uganda to be rounded up and put on an island in the middle of Lake Victoria. Could you just talk briefly about the stigma of homophobia and how important it is in fighting AIDS that we deal with that stigma as well? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sven Robinson from Canada. And I think the important point you're making about that stigma, I'll say simply that there is an analogy, a very clear analogy with many people who discover their own sexual orientation, either an ambivalence or an LGBTI orientation within themselves. They feel that similar self-loathing, which I think HIV people at risk of HIV or with HIV feel. But the more important point you make, Sven, is about the silence that surrounds man-to-man transmission of HIV in Africa. And that is the externalization of the stigma surrounding homosexuality. And it's causing deaths. In International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Committee produced a very fine study of the way that there's silence about man-to-man transmission of HIV in Africa. And thank you for raising the issue.
Scott. It's shocking that, Scott Burris from the USA, it's shocking that there's still a study, a review of art of stigma that talks only about external stigma. And the point you make about the way we protect ourselves really reveals how much we ignore another body of evidence about stigma that really supports your point about the internal stigma. The classic way that people protect themselves from stigma is to hide, to keep it secret. And every time we pass a confidentiality law that emphasizes to people the importance of secrecy, we're not only protecting their privacy, we're disciplining them to hide. And this is not just an academic point, I think, because it seems to me that I've never heard of a stigma that has been defeated by dealing with what others think. Mm. All I can think of are cases where stigmas were destroyed by the people who were stigmatized themselves, rising up and rejecting the stigma and telling the rest of the world to go to hell. I'm wondering if you can think of an occasion in which we have protected people out of a stigma, or whether or not true action against stigma inevitably and exclusively requires action by the stigmatized people themselves.
Well, Scott's being even more provocative, ladies and gentlemen. I remember being told by a South African who emigrated to London who was Jewish that he had changed his name because he didn't want people to know that he was Jewish. And I think that there's a similar thing, that where you're hiding the identity of your religion and your origins of 5,000 years of history and your own culture, I think that's the analogy. And of course, one wishes people, whether they Muslim or Jewish or whatever they are, to assert with pride their own cultural and other identity, cultural and religious identity. And your point is that it's got to come from within. You've got to say, to hell with changing of Lithuanian or plainly Jewish surnames. We're going to stick with this. And there is an analogy there, and thank you for raising that point.
Sorry, everyone. Let's move on to the next speaker. I know a lot of people want to speak, and we've already got into an exciting discussion here, but let's hear the next speaker. And I'd like to introduce Anandi Yuvarajah. She is from the Asia-Pacific Regional Coordinator of ICW, based in Bangkok. Prior to joining ICW, Anandi worked as Program Manager for HIV and Sexual Reproductive Health at PATH's India office, where she managed an advocacy project of the Global Campaign for Microbicides in India. She was also employed by the International HIV-AIDS Alliance in India as Senior Program Officer for over 5 years. Since testing HIV positive in 1997, she has played a vital role in broadening political and social responses to the epidemic in India. She began her work by establishing a local organization to support fellow people living with HIV in her own community, which continues to be a strong and effective program. Anandi, please.
Thank you, Susan, for that long introduction. You know how difficult it is to come after Edwin Cameron has spoken such a thought-provoking, introduction. Good afternoon. I'm here to present a joint initiative of four international organizations. The presentations aim to give brief overview of the processes involved in developing the initiative and some aspects of the vision for this initiative. So this is the initiative. What is Stigma Index? As it's being projected here, it aims to track the level of stigma and discrimination experienced by positive people. And it also helps to measure the direct experience of stigma, which manifests in the form of discrimination. And as the Princey of the person who is featuring here says, it helps to unwind and open up the secrets of stigma and discrimination that they have experienced. So that's the tool is all about. And this disclaimer that the institutions have put together, the index strongly promotes the need to use the toolkit in its entirety as outlined in the user guide. And the user guide has been finalized. But if anyone wants to adapt this in part or in whole, they may need to ensure that the additional ethical and other requirements are met appropriately before use. So read the disclaimer before you plan to use. Who are the partners in this initiative? International Community of Women Living with HIV and Global Network of People Living with HIV, International Planned Parenthood Federation, and UNAIDS. So they came together and they got involved in this joint venture to produce this index. And we have piloted this toolkit in these countries like India, Kenya, Lesotho, South Africa, Trinidad, and Tobago. And the tools have been already revised and finalized. It's ready for rollout. Why it was developed? These are the rationale for developing the index. It helps us to measure the level of stigma and discrimination experienced by individuals, both perceived and actual. It also helps to compare the changes that has occurred over a period of time, whether people living with HIV are attributing the stigma to HIV status or other related factors such as sex work, injecting drug use, or sexual orientation, or poverty, or a combination of these all. The tool also helps to generate evidences of stigma and discrimination in a day-to-day life of an individual, starting from home, immediate family, and at workplace, and in the healthcare settings, which then could be consolidated at the community level to take appropriate action to address the challenges of stigma and discrimination. This will help to create an enabling environment for people living with HIV to access the services and thus helps to achieve our universal access. There are other tools, how this index, you know, how it fills the gap. There are other stigma index, stigma tools that exist to measure general attitudes and prejudices that are prevailing in the community and among healthcare providers against people living with HIV, but no other index specific to measure stigma and discrimination experienced by people living with HIV. And, you know, it's been interviewed and documented by people living with HIV. So thus it complements the existing tools. What are the key aspects of the stigma index? The key areas that the index explores are stigma and discrimination and their root causes and the access to work and services and internal stigma, rights and laws and policies, whether they know about the existing laws, whether they are aware of any international agreements on human rights, and disclosure and confidentiality, and whether they have access to treatment, what are the issues that they are facing in the healthcare settings and the workplace, and whether healthcare providers are considering their options in terms of having a family or having children, and what are the problems and challenges that they are facing. And the key process aspects are, why it is so important is the stigma questionnaire index, the tool, is being administered by people living with HIV, with people living with HIV. So these are the key aspects, side-by-side interviewing. It helps for the interviewee to be in a comfortable position to, you know, to express and share some of their concerns and, you know, how they have experienced stigma, if at all they have experienced any discrimination in any of these areas. So the interviewer is also a person living with HIV. So both interviewee as well as the interviewer benefit from this process. It's very empowering. And also, you know, it's very important that we felt, you know, referrals is very important aspect of this toolkit rollout. As the index moves from concept to scale up, it will be adapted by a variety of different PLHIV groups, and it contributes to meaningful involvement of PLHG in the response. And other aspects are confidentiality and informed consent agreements for everybody who is involved in rolling out the toolkit, right from the researchers, right, and the data analysis, and the people who interview, and interviewer, investigators, everybody has to fill up these agreements before they are involved in this process. What we have learned along this, along the way, some of the key findings that came out of this process is many interviewers often felt that interview process ends up being about sharing information about the stigma is what discrimination looks like. For example, one of the interviewers in the Dominican Republic explained how she interviewed one woman who said, no, her family was very supportive and she had never experienced stigma in the home. She then went on to give an example where she described how every day her family set aside separate knife, fork, plate, etc. to be extra careful for her sake. I know this experience was also similar in some of the pilot countries. And how was the role out of the index being implemented? And we have conducted the regional capacity building workshops where we have, I think, in Kathmandu, Bangkok, Nairobi, in Dhaka, Santov, these are the places, countries where the capacity building workshops have been conducted. And the most important thing, I'm just translating what has been written there with my colleagues who are featuring there. The most important thing is to start with communication with the community. It is not moral disease, it is a viral one. This is the nearest translation. So just that's the thing I could, you know, make out here. And these are some of the feelings of people who have participated in this process. And this slide also brings me back all the memories or changes that occurred to me during the interview process as an investigator, PLHIV investigator. Often I have observed that PLHIV are perceived to be converted or transformed souls just because we are diagnosed or are living with HIV. And so they are, you know, we are sensitized to issues of people who belong to most marginalized communities like sex workers who are positive, MSM positive, or transgenders who are positive. We all must admit and recognize that we, the people living with HIV, also need sensitization programs to internalize the issues faced by our fellow friends who are being to, who belong to one of these groups. It does not happen overnight. Just because we are diagnosed HIV positive, everyone needs the safe space for internalization. And the difference is how much time we take. Maybe because of the virus, we take less time. For others, it takes longer time. I felt, as I stated, the interview is a two-way process. And see, some key lessons from regional rollout are, like as I explained, in the interview process, the referrals, requirements were very obvious and it were identified in the process. And the Dominican example that I gave might qualify to capture the essence of the issue to support the qualitative studies. And these are the vision for the future. The seed grants have been already, given out and it's been already initiated. And we all know that this is not enough. We need more, countries to, take up these toolkits and integrate into their national rollout plan. And the last bullet is my personal vision for this toolkit. Advocate with the national governments in Asia-Pacific region for integrating the index into their ongoing stigma reduction strategy. Thank you. The last thing is there is a WW Stigma Index is launched, and you can access all the information about the index in the website. Sorry, it's not, the slide is not here. I don't know, some of it got messed up. Thank you. www.stigmaindex.com.
Okay, thank you very much, Anandi, for presenting this very interesting combination tool. It seems to sort of bridge the gap we've already talked about between internal and external stigma, allowing the individual to clarify within his or her own mind the stigma that she or he has experienced, and perhaps thereby empowering the person, as Scott has said, to challenge that stigma. And at the same time, creating an evidence base that we need so desperately on these issues for advocacy and change. Do we have anyone who would like to ask Anandi a couple of questions? Questions? Here comes someone. Two people.
Very quickly, on the website, is the whole tool and kit available?
The toolkit is not available. If anybody from IPPF here to talk about, my understanding is the toolkit is not uploaded. But the experiences have been there, and you know, the related toolkits, related stigma and discriminated toolkits are up there. I don't know whether, I haven't checked it, but Lucy from IPPF could comment on that. Could you please, to that, whether the user guide and the questionnaire is already there, up there.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks, Anandi. Just for everyone, it's www.stigmaindex.org.
But
I think .com should work as well, but org is the direct one. And the materials on there is the user guide that explains the rationale and the sections of the index, and it's in French, Spanish, and English at the moment. But the actual questionnaire is not there because of the commitment to process, and we want to make sure that, as Anandi said, the disclaimer is, and the ethos of the project is right in each place. So some of the support materials are there, but not the questionnaire.
Thanks, Lucy, for stepping in.
Okay, we'll take one more question now, and then we'll open it up.
I have a question, but I prefer speaking Spanish. Anyone translate?
Sorry?
I have a question, but I prefer speaking Spanish.
Yeah, please, go ahead, and somebody can translate. I don't have
somebody translate,
necessary.
Please?
Here, we're getting you a headset. We need headsets up here.
Okay. Creo que... Para todos quedó claro que el índice se puede convertir en una herramienta para empoderar a las personas que vivimos con VIH. Sin embargo, creo que no es muy claro, aunque tú lo propusiste y me gustaría que ampliaras eso, es cómo podemos hacer para que la herramienta, el índice, sea tomado dentro de nuestros gobiernos como una herramienta para generar cambios en las políticas públicas en salud y en las políticas públicas en general que nos ayude a mejorar las condiciones de vida de las personas viviendo con VIH.
Well, thanks for that comment. I would encourage all the governments to, because right now my understanding from the place where I come from, we do have tools, but the tools have not been scaled up, they have not been utilized by the government and NGOs to address the stigma and discrimination, or to measure the stigma and discrimination to be enough. So it's important we keep saying in every strategic plan document that stigma is the major challenge. And how long do we want to hear and see that keep reflecting on the document? It's a tight time to really standardize these tools and, you know, select these tools and roll it out in the plan so that, you know, we don't end up saying in 2010 or 12, you know, that stigma is still exists.
Thank you very much, Anandi. Okay, let me turn to our next speaker. Our next speaker is Laura Nyblade. Laura is the lead researcher on HIV stigma at the International Committee for Research on Women. As a senior social scientist, Laura has over 15 years of experience in HIV and AIDS research throughout Africa and South and Southeast Asia. Her research focuses extensively on HIV-related stigma and turning that knowledge into action to reduce HIV stigma. This has included developing, testing, and evaluating stigma reduction implementation tools and intervention approaches, as well as measures to assess the effects of this effort. Laura, thank you.
Thanks, Susan, for that introduction. And I just want to start by saying I have 10 minutes to cover a very broad topic, so I'm going to try and do a mix of very kind of generalized lessons that we've learned, as well as integrating that with an example of how we actually do stigma reduction. And if you take home one message from this, I think it's what Anandi said so well. We need the evidence, but we have enough evidence now to act. So we need to move forward. We need to raise this up and to say we need to continue gathering evidence using tools, but we also know enough now to act. So the question is, why are we not acting? Why are we not scaling up the things that we know, the tools that we have? So... to start, I won't talk about the first two because that's been very well covered. One of the things we know from all of our global work is that stigma is really common at its core. This is a universal human attribute, and it is contextually specific, and we will need to respond to it in our given context, but the message we really have learned from all of our work over the past years is that it's really common in both its causes, its forms, and its consequences. And that helps us very much in creating a response and being able to scale that up. We know it's differentially experienced by women and men and by different vulnerable groups. And again, that's part of how we need to look at it when we think about how we're responding to stigma reduction. We know it's actionable. We have enough good programs across the globe that are actually reducing stigma. But as Paul had said, they're scattered, they're far between, and we need to bring this together and really raise our efforts. And we know that we can measure what we're doing. Often I hear from donors, oh, we can't fund stigma because we won't know whether we're having any effect. We have measures. We just heard about the toolkit. We have other measures. So that's no longer an excuse for inaction. Now I'm going on to the simplification. What we know from all of the work that we have seen across the globe is that there are three things that are the base, whether you're working with general populations, with people living with HIV, in healthcare settings, with policymakers. We need to create awareness of what stigma is. I think the example that Anandi gave is so clear. Even with a person living with HIV saying, I'm not experiencing stigma, and then going on to describe that I have separate dishes, that my family is treating me differently in some way. And what we find actually across the globe is that intentions are not necessarily to harm or to stigmatize, but that we don't recognize that when we do X, we are actually stigmatizing, and what are the consequences of that? For example, in a lot of the work we see, gossip is one of the key forms of stigma that particularly women fear. Do we think about gossip as a form of stigma, and do we think about that in our own actions? The second is the fear of casual contact. There is a lot of stigma that, and particularly in the manifestation of isolation, that is being driven by fear of casual contact. Despite our decades of communication campaigns, there is still a real fear of contracting HIV through casual contact. We need to address this, and something is wrong in our programs if people can spew out on CAP surveys how HIV is transmitted, and then when you actually ask them, well, do you really believe that, or how does that translate into your actions, they'll say, well, actually, I'm not really sure, so I'm not going to do that because it's just too big a risk. So we need to address that part of it. We need to address the values that are linking HIV with immoral behavior. This is shaming and blaming that goes on, this judgment that goes on. And I'll talk a little bit later about the layered stigmas that was brought up by one of our speakers, the stigma that's related to sex work, to men who have sex with men. And we need to address it at multiple levels. There's different ways of thinking about that, at the individual level, at the environmental level, or the structural. You can think about it as working with the individual, communities, at the regional, at the national level. We need to address attitudes and behavior, meet the needs for information. So, for example, if we don't understand what stigma is, how can we start acting against it? And talking about those policies, laws, and systems, there was a session right before this about criminalization of HIV, and what does that mean for stigma and discrimination? So now I'm going to talk a little bit, just one example, and I've picked this out because we so rarely hear about work in the community. And this is a community-led stigma reduction program in Vietnam. And I'm going to use it as an example to illustrate some of the sort of principles that are emerging from our work globally and that are promising and can be scaled up. This program, multiple partners, it's the communities of Cai Cay and Cam Dong in Vietnam, the Communist Party of Vietnam, the Institute for Social Development Studies, ICRW, PACT, and it was funded by USAID through PEPFAR. Key lessons from this, and I'll describe a little bit about what the program looked like. But the first is gatekeepers, particularly when we're talking about addressing issues where criminalization is involved, in Vietnam, injecting drug use being key issue in these communities. Getting the gatekeepers on board is incredibly critical. And using multiple change agents within the community. In this case, it was working with the local Communist Party, with women's organizations, youth, healthcare workers, and the security forces. It's creating understanding among those gatekeepers and leaders so that they will actually start working on these issues and take it on as their own. So creating an understanding of why they should care about stigma and creating motivation for doing something about it. This happened very effectively in these communities. And one of the key ways that we worked to create ownership was actually through, after some education and participatory methodology to really understand what stigma was, then creating an action planning workshop where the communities themselves then decided what their program was going to look like. So we were providing some seed money for stigma reduction in the community and support to do that, but they decided what the program was going to look like and what it was going to be. The second was using a range and combination of approaches. Throughout this conference, particularly on the prevention side, we've been hearing about combination approaches and the importance of it. That goes for stigma reduction as well. What we found that was that different target audiences within the community respond in different ways. On the evaluation, we actually see also that we can show very clearly a dose response effect. The more program activities a person was exposed to, the better the reduction in their own stigma scores. So we use participatory learning, community educators, and community meetings. The second, other things that were used were billboards and fact sheets and slogans. And I want to talk about the fact sheets in particular. One of the things we know, and this goes to the whole issue of the fear of casual transmission, is the need for very clear and quite detailed information that addresses a community's specific fears. So what is it in my daily life that I fear about casual transmission? Is it in the tea shop? Is it in the coffee ceremony? Is it in the bus? Addressing those fears specifically and explaining why HIV cannot be transmitted in those circumstances. In Vietnam, the fact sheets were very effective. They were delivered door-to-door in the community by the community educators who were actually leaders in the community. So they came along with that. And we actually found in the community meetings that people had read them and were coming back and asking questions. So it provided an opportunity for an interactive back and forth about what was in it. So I could give you a whole session on just what the results were. But to say that this was evaluated, we did this in different ways. We had random sample survey, cross-sectional, baseline, end line. We had qualitative data collection, baseline end line midterm. We also had routine monitoring data to look at what was actually happening in terms of the actual delivery. And in both communities, over 90% of the respondents reported that they had participated in at least one activity. So we had very high coverage in these communities of around 20,000 people. We had statistically significant increase in stigma awareness, a reduction in fear of casual transmission and stigmatizing attitudes when we measured baseline to end line. This was both in individual items and in an overall index score. We looked at what was happening at end line, comparing people who had been exposed and not exposed to a various number of activities, so comparing 0 to 1, 2, 3, and 4. And like I mentioned earlier, we could see a dose response. The more activities a person had been exposed to, the better their score was, meaning it was lower. And then the qualitative data, which described clearly what was going on, particularly around the changes in stigmatizing behavior and discrimination that was happening in the community. And this was most clearly documented by people living with HIV and their family members. As this person said, in general, is much different than before. Before, people did not dare to visit a house that had a person living with HIV. Now they visit as normal, they contact as normal, talk as normal, and eat as normal. They even share the same eating tray, drink alcohol together, no problem. Before, they did not even dare to visit my house. So I think there was some discussion earlier about the need to normalize. And I think, you know, in this program, that has been something that the people living with HIV said was most critical for them, was this sort of normalization again of their relationships in the community, and that this is very possible to do. It was a 16-month program. What additionally we've learned globally, and which I'm not highlighting from this program, we can talk about this a little bit later, but was brought up by our speakers, was the central role for people living with HIV in other marginalized groups that are experiencing stigma. And as was spoken about earlier, that this needs to be done in a safe way, and addressing internalized stigma, I think, is probably the first step in that. I think a lot of times in our programs, we sort of say, okay, well, we just need to have someone living with HIV come and give testimony about what's going on. So there needs to be first creating the space, as Anandi talked about, to deal with internalized stigma, build the skills, and then have people living with HIV or other groups experiencing stigma actually delivering the programs. This was very difficult in our communities in Vietnam because the level of stigma and discrimination was so high when we started that there was no one in the community living with HIV who was comfortable being actually public and working in the program. That changed over the course of the program. The second is addressing those multiple layers of stigma. One of our questions was about homophobia. If we're going to address HIV stigma, and this is another lesson we learned in Vietnam, you can't just address HIV stigma. You have to address the stigma related to sex work, to injecting drug use in our case, and to homophobia, sexuality in different ways. And that's actually our next phase is really looking at how do we address stigma around injecting drug use and developing tools for that. And the lastly is starting at home and working with different organizations. Many of us who have been working in HIV for a long time think that we don't stigmatize ourselves and that our organizations are not doing anything that's stigmatizing. The first place is to start at home and really critically reflect and look at what your own organization is doing and creating the training and space for your own staff before you go out to do stigma reduction. And lastly, just to talk about where we are, I was asked to review the evidence base, and as Justice Cameron said, there is a review article that just came out. It does state that we have a long ways to go in terms of actual evaluated programs. But what I'd like to say is, yes, they are few and far between, but we know that there's a lot of good work going out there, and we do need to have those programs evaluated, but we know enough to actually start moving. One of the things that I often hear is all we have to do is provide treatment and stigma will go away. We need more evidence around the relationship between treatment availability and stigma, and I think our next speaker will talk about the realities in a place where treatment is available. The second is really being able to, we all know and we about how stigma impedes prevention, care, and support, but we have less evidence that shows when you reduce stigma, you actually improve the uptake of those services and make it more possible for people to access those services. So we need more evidence around that. We need to understand and evaluate what's going on with our programs, particularly as we start to scale up, which I hope will be happening in the coming years, and understanding how do you scale up these programs. We know that we need to be gender responsive in our stigma reduction, and we need to know more and about how we do that well. How do we address the layered stigma? How do we address the interactions between stigma around sex work and HIV, around MSM and HIV? We don't know a lot about those interactions and that layered stigma, and how do we respond to that effectively? We need more measurement and evaluation. We have good tools for that. I think we've come a long ways. Anandi's presentation is just a good example of that. We have others. And so we need to do more about that. And we need to know about the costs. I think in terms of actually moving stigma along, we need to be able to show what are the costs of not addressing stigma and discrimination. How is that affecting the effectiveness of our prevention, care, and treatment programs? And then knowing more about what programs actually cost. Thank you.
Already have somebody lining up for a question. That's great. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Nicholas Little. I'm from Ottawa, Canada. in the previous presentation, we saw a quote from a participant saying that reducing stigma and programs to reduce stigma can only come from people living with HIV themselves. I'm an HIV negative gay man who does have relationships and does have sex with HIV positive men, and I appreciate the work that you do, and I also would just like to make the comment that despite the fact that I am open to have serodivergent relationships and sex, the province where I live in the fall, they'll roll out a new stigma campaign, and it's aimed specifically at the MSM community about stigma within that community. And the tagline is, if you were rejected every time you disclosed, would you? And I'd just like to say that HIV-negative people, and I speak as a gay man, HIV-negative gay men are allies in social justice for people living with HIV, but also we want to be allies with deep, loving relationships and also having damn good sex together. And so I'd just like to suggest that, in fact, HIV-negative people can play a very large role in this, but we do need tools. We do need to unlearn stigma and HIV phobia, and there are many of us who are willing to do it.
One more question.
Hi, I'm Christo Greiling. I'm chairperson of INERELLA, the network of religious leaders living with HIV or personally affected by HIV. I'm thankful for the stigma index and also the fact that you said that people do not know enough yet about HIV and that contributes to stigma, but also the role of gatekeepers. And we've seen that there's so much criticism against what the faith communities has done wrong, but we've also seen that if they are challenged on their stigma, they can change and become positive change agents. I want to know, have you in the stigma index included faith-related issues on where the faith communities might have done something wrong to contribute to that, so that we can also measure where it comes right when they do something right? And I just want to say thank you for the work.
Thank you. Sounds like it was a question for our previous speaker, Anandi. Do you want to?
Does the index explore whether you belong to this religion? And it is the religion's, is an aspect of the questionnaire which helps to explore that dimension. So, yeah, yes.
Okay. I'm going to take over from Susan and introduce you to our next two speakers. Angela Pinto is a law graduate. She has a law degree, and she's also a human rights expert. For 10 years, she's been working in human rights defense, especially for women and people living with HIV. For the last 2 years, she has been an human rights advisor for the National STD AIDS program in Brazil.
Good. Thank you, Susan. Thank you, Paul. Good afternoon, everyone. First, I'd like to thank my colleague Jacqueline Cortes and Paul Pershaw and all NGOs and networks from Brazil who are here with us. I hope you can see yourself in my presentation. To start this presentation, it's important to say that when HIV was discovered, Brazil was moving towards its democracy. After many years of a dictatorial government, we were all mobilized on fighting for human rights and for a health system that could fit every single person. So, since the beginning of this epidemic, Brazil has identified stigma and discrimination as an important issue. And that's why we have built our response on a tripod: prevention, treatment, care and support, and human rights. For us, the stigma and discrimination are an important component of vulnerability, and their presence can be a serious obstacle to the effective universal access. It's also important to say that the strategies that we have been developing are connected to three important principles: equity, universality, and integrality, that guide all strategies in our public health system that we call SUS. So I'd like to share a bit of our story that started with peoples and NGOs making advocacy for the change on legislation. Our constitution, built in 1988, is based on human rights principles, and the Article 196 says that health is a right of all citizens and government must provide all support. During the 80s and 90s, we have changed a lot of our legislation just to guarantee the human rights of people living with HIV and AIDS. So nowadays, legislation is not a problem for us, but its implementation in a large and developing country as Brazil is still a challenge. As a strategy on human rights defense, we have been supporting NGOs with technical and financial support to provide legal assistance. Right now, we support 47 NGOs that are distributed throughout the country. And last year, we have built a database to register cases of human rights violations, hoping that it can help us to fill this lack of indicators about stigma and discrimination and to help us to build our policies. It's a database that can be accessed through the internet, and these 47 NGOs register more than 500 cases of human rights violations just this year. But we have learned that defending human rights is not enough. We have to promote human rights, like considering people's autonomy to be tested, not judging their profession, gender identity, sexual orientation. The state has to provide care to all your citizens. We started to work together with NGOs and networks, empowering people, especially the groups affected by this epidemic, to know their rights and fight for them. And the distance between vulnerable groups and the public health system has become shorter. And during the last few years, we started to build integrated agendas. Like, there are some examples, like the plan against feminization of epidemic and the plan against the epidemic between gays, men who have sex with men, and transvestites. I'd like to highlight here that it's so important to listen to the vulnerable groups, involve them on building the response and providing information and financial support. These are some of our campaigns. Recently, we have started to build an integrated agenda regarding people living with HIV and AIDS, including children, youth, disabilities, understanding that they have other needs, like job, education, culture, social protection, a home to live, the right to come and go, and stigma and discrimination based on health status still remain as a serious obstacle to their quality of life. So, after 12 years of universal access to antiretrovirus, we can say that fighting only for ARV is not enough. We still have many challenges. We have to fight against stigma and discrimination. We have to fight against homophobia, transphobia, lesbophobia. We have to fight against gender inequality and poverty. It means that health efforts are not enough. So all sectors must be involved, all stakeholders. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Angela. Are there any questions for Angela? We'll take one or two questions at this point. Somebody have their hand up? As they're making their way to the microphone, I just wanted to say, observing the success of the Brazilian AIDS program, I think has a lot to do with the fact that they recognized very early on that it was a human rights issue, but there are many countries in the world where that kind of a creative, supportive environment doesn't exist. And so what are the implications for that for stigma reduction work? Go ahead, please.
Hi, I'm a little out of breath now. My name is Kim Vance. I work with a group called ARC International. We're based in Canada and Switzerland. My question is about, I'm quite familiar with the policies in Brazil and the amazing work done with NGOs there. But Brazil still remains one of the countries with the highest rates of violence targeted towards LGBT people. And so there's a disconnect there for me. And I'm wondering whether how all of this translates into impact. Sorry, I'm out of breath.
Thank you very much. The LGBT movement, it's a partner very important for us in Brazil. Let me show you before. You have this magazine that it's in English and Spanish. You can find it on our stand, Brazil. And that shows a lot about our work that we do. We have supported NGOs, and we have supported also actions on prevention and human rights during the GLBT's pride parties. And it's an opportunity to say that prevention, human rights, and fighting against stigma and discrimination can help us to confront this epidemic. Okay, thank you very much.
I think it also highlights the need for a multifaceted approach to this issue. You know, a country like Brazil is very diverse and has both a large urban and a large rural population. And so, when you look at those demographics, I think you have to come up with very innovative approaches to dealing with the different manifestations of stigma and human rights violations. Okay, is there one more question or a comment? Okay, we'll take one last and we'll move on to the next speaker.
Okay, I'm Vera Paiva from Brazil. I just want to help you answer the question. we have a huge violence problem in Brazil. That this is the big background for that, more than what the AIDS program can do on stigma and discrimination against people living with HIV or against homophobia. What she could have said is that the National Program of AIDS and the state's program of AIDS, for example, fund gay parades all over the country, right? As a tactic, as a strategic to fight against homophobic. What we cannot do as a health program, and I'm not part of it, I'm at the university, is to fight against inequality and the violence that at the end plays out homophobic actions too. But I mean, this is a different picture, okay?
Thank you. We'll move on to our final speaker, who is Dr. Mariam Klassen. Dr. Klassen is a regional program coordinator for AIDS in the South Asia region of the World Bank since January 2005. She is currently coordinating the South Asia Regional Development Marketplace Initiative, tackling HIV-related stigma and discrimination. It's a competitive grants program providing grants to 26 NGOs and civil society groups in six countries that are implementing and monitoring innovative approaches to tackling stigma. Go ahead.
Thank you, Paul. And thanks to the previous panelists who have made my task so much simpler, which is to talk about how to get stigma and stigma reduction onto the donor's agenda. In this session, at this moment, we are all talking about stigma and stigma reduction. What I think is so striking is that stigma is a theme that runs through all sessions at this conference, either explicitly so or implicit. You cannot talk about scaling up, programmatic effectiveness, universal access, all those goals and ambitions without tackling stigma. And stigma is there throughout as an undercurrent theme. The fact that I've been asked to talk about stigma and giving a donor's perspective, I hope is not just because I do represent a donor, but as Paul said, we have been trying to put stigma up front on the regional agenda in South Asia, and we would like to share some of those experiences. Now, why should donors care about stigma, and how can we move from rhetoric to actions? Well, one reason why donors should care, and we're talking about the donors that put financial resources behind words, helping us move from rhetoric to action, but clearly, first of all, donors should care. Because if they do want, and we all want to scale up, if we want to achieve results, and we're doing it in a serious way, we have to look at the bottlenecks. What are the bottlenecks within households, local communities, in reaching health facilities, services? What are the programmatic bottlenecks? And any serious attempts to analyze, identify, and deal with bottlenecks run up against stigma. Stigma is always the bottlenecks. Even when you look at the sort of macroeconomic analysis that we are now trying to undertake and looking at what the consequences are of HIV/AIDS in low prevalence areas with concentrated epidemics, if you add stigma into the equations, you achieve totally different kinds of numbers and figures. It's huge. Stigma is something that everybody who has an interest in AIDS will report on as the main problem at all levels, in all areas, in all cultures. So that's a reason why donors should care. Secondly, donors should care because there's a lot of innovations out there. This is a huge marketplace of innovative ideas. When we launched the marketplace for stigma reduction, we thought very few would come forward because, you know, there is all this money out there. So why would anyone care to come forward with an innovative ideas for tackling stigma? We got 1,000 proposals from South Asia, from all corners of Afghanistan, Pakistan, Nepal, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, and India. And these were things dealing with the kind of internal stigma that was mentioned earlier, to the more getting stigma into the policies that enables kids to go to schools, etc. So there is a large demand, an unfunded mandate, demand for finances to support innovative solutions. There's a large, huge, unfunded agenda. The fourth reason why donors should care is that stigma does not compete with other resources. It complements the other resources. Stigma will make money work Stigma will help those interested in maximizing the benefits of their current investments and future investments. Stigma will help them achieve that goal. So why don't they? Why aren't we now seeing a huge financial support for stigma reduction? Well, first of all, probably still that perceived lack of evidence-based intervention and programs and indicators, which of course have been challenged by this panel. And one thing I think we should all keep in mind is that there are many initiatives that has got huge backing international for which there were no evidence at all, or even, you know, so we know that. And at the same time, there are huge, there are no money behind other things for which we have more evidence. So there's clearly not necessarily an immediate connection between providing the evidence and getting the funding. So evidence is a necessary but obviously not a sufficient factor for priority setting and resource allocation. Now, do you think it is the norm? The norm, the things we feel comfortable about, is global solutions to local problems. And clearly, if you want to tackle stigma, it's about local solutions to a global problem. So that shift might make some uncomfortable. Is it the face of stigma that we haven't that, you know, attractive poster child to put up for stigma reduction? Is that why? Stigma, as we know, is about marginalization, marginalized groups. It's about sex work and injecting drug use. It's about things that often are illegal and criminalized. Is that something that we have to tackle in order to mobilize these resources? You know, I think it's really about the lack of flexible funding. Many of you have experienced the same as we did, I'm sure. There are willing donors, but not yet, notice, yet able, and there are donors that are able, but not yet willing to put their money behind stigma reductions. Either when you come with a proposal, you will hear, well, it's too little, or you will hear, well, it's too little, so it's not worth the transaction cost, or you will hear it's too much you're asking for. You will hear that it's a good idea, but you're coming too late. We made our decisions, or you're coming too early for the next cycle. So we have many reasons given why, and I think these are all reasons that can be tackled. Now, development partners and UN has this division of labor. It might work for areas where they're sort of tripping over each other, trying to fund, you know, but in areas like stigma that cuts across various sectors and agencies, it doesn't really work for stigma. Because stigma is in everybody's sort of sphere of interest. It's everybody's business, but nobody's responsibility. So if these are some of the reasons, how do we move forward? Well, first of all, presenting evidence and give voice is clearly an important instrument. I think what we all fear is that when we want to tackle stigma right on, it might drown under the big rubrics of structural amplifiers, structural determinants, social factors. So how do we bring stigma out of that as really the thing we need to tackle heads on? Maybe we need a forum, a global forum that has stigma as its key issue. The other thing is mainstreaming stigma into international planning processes. If there are indicators, clearly they should be in every toolbox for every national programs. You look what you find what you look for. That's a good principles in monitoring and evaluation. So just getting these indicators as part of the, you know, aid strategic planning exercises and toolkits is of course a given. Thirdly, I think we have to place this stigma not just in the domain of the human rights, but also as the integral to any intelligent, sound epidemiological response. It's just part of that. If we're going to tailor our response, the current buzzword, tailor it, adapt, then clearly we need to tackle stigma. So we can't really afford spending more money that doesn't buy results, and tackling stigma will help us do so. So what it means for each one of us, I think for civil society, keep the pressure on, make sure that when we try to articulate ideas for tackling stigma, that we really focus on the actions and the results we want to achieve. You know, it's not about feel goods. It really is about a very serious problem where we want to see results. For national programs, the first, I think, sort of a minimum is to make sure you have representatives of vulnerable and marginalized groups, not just as a token reviewer on your programs and proposals, but as in the decision-making roles and functions, and that definitely that you engage peers in implementing any program that you are supporting, be it harm reduction, clean needle exchange, or condom use. So there are many ways we could rapidly move forward in mainstreaming it. To partners and donors, I would say, yes, we have the divisional labor. Next time you have one of those coordinating meeting at country, regional, global level, make sure stigma is on that agenda and who's going to take the lead and move that forward. For the very big donors, clearly stigma is just as exciting, just as promising a work program as many of the other very exciting and promising things that we are discussing in other main sessions. So this is clearly a very vibrant, exciting area of work that will make a difference to the global epidemic. Thank you.
Thanks, Mariam. You want to stay up there? We have time for one or two questions for Mariam. Go ahead, please.
Firstly, I must apologize. I missed the first speaker, Judge Cameron, so I do hope I'm not raising something that's already been covered. I actually have two questions. One is, I wonder often if certain government policies are contributing very strongly towards stigma. For example, VCT. I have to be tested every 2 years for various types of cancer, but I'm not pre-test or post-test counseled. I rely on my doctor that if the news is bad, that he will refer me to a relevant counselor. And I feel personally from experience in rural South Africa that this is a big contributing factor to sort of stigmatizing the disease. The second question is that I'm very interested in knowing more about innovative strategies, because we are in the learning stages of how to address stigma, the organization I represent. And we feel that there's a huge window of opportunity in working with children to address stigma, because obviously if it's in the school curriculum, then it is sustainable over the years. And I wonder if you could perhaps refer us to, or a website that can teach us, that can tell us more about people who have tried this and how it's working. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Those are two very good questions. Mm-hmm. They're more general questions. If Mariam wants to answer either of them, otherwise we can save them for mm-hmm. when we open it up for general discussion for all the panels. Okay, thanks. Does anybody have a specific question for Mariam based on her presentation?
Well, yes and no.
Okay, well, let's hear it. I just wanted to
thank you all very much for your work. And during this presentation, yes, I really think stigma should have been, instead of universal action now, I really think your suggestion of a summit, et cetera, is very significant. And I wanted to challenge everyone here that stigma is not something that is going to be able to be contained or addressed very quickly. Even in a nation, I work in Los Angeles. I've been seeing patients, taking care of patients for 28 years, and I am still dealing with stigma. We've made incredible progress. I'm hardly losing patients, and yet there's really been very little progress in this area. And so the challenge is, this is an area that we really must work very hard on. And, you know, from the beginning of having families telling me to change the diagnosis on death certificates until now, in my society where we have every treatment available, still having patients coming to me and not telling their family members about their diagnosis. So there's a hole in my heart that with all the progress we've made in such a long period of time, it's been such baby steps in this arena. And I really think we need to really work on this more. Mm-hmm. I just don't understand why it's taking so long.
Okay. Thanks for your comment. Okay. Let's open it up for general Q&A. And we had two very good questions. The first one had to do with, are we contributing to stigma, and the example of voluntary counseling and testing programs. Anybody on the panel want to address that, Edwin?
I just wanted to, perhaps I could just tell the lady that that's exactly the point I try to make. Yeah. And I often think of a friend of mine who was diagnosed last year with breast cancer, and she eventually had to have a double-sided removal of her breasts. But while she was still sitting in the doctor's office and he'd gone out, she sent out a text to all of us saying, I've just been diagnosed with breast cancer. And Within half an hour, I'm sure she was deluged with texts. I responded immediately. She eventually wrote her story in the main national newspaper, the Sunday Times in South Africa. We're not there yet, but certainly to go back to your question, her doctor didn't say, whoa, you've got a lump in your breast, go for counseling first. He said, we're going to diagnose you right away and do something about it. And my point exactly, that the hullabaloo inhibiting testing contributes to stigma.
Thanks. And then your second question had to do with innovative approaches to working with other groups such as children, is that right? Yeah. Laura, do you want to respond?
Maybe I would be happy to address that question. There is no website that pulls together all of the sort of creative things that are going on around the globe, and I think that is a real gap, and I hope perhaps there's a donor sitting in the room that will be hearing that. There are a lot of innovative strategies, and I know we don't have time. I'd be glad to talk to you about some of the things we've been doing. We also have a poster tomorrow that describes in more detail the Vietnamese community-led action program. I'd also like to just quickly address the question about, I think that was made so eloquently, changing stigma takes time, and I think that's part of the problem with the funding. We have donors who are on one-year timelines, in our case in the U.S., who want to see results in a year. You're not going to be able to have measurable results around stigma reduction within a year. So I think it's also in the funding arena and thinking about our timeline. I think there's been a lot of discussion in the sort of larger forums here around thinking on a longer term, and that's clearly an issue with stigma.
Thanks, Laura. Okay, I see four more people lined up, and we're running out of time. So we'll take all four questions, and if you could make them short and concise. And then we'll hear from Susan. She'll provide us with some closing remarks. Thanks.
David Lush from Namibia. I'd just like to get the panel's thoughts on a finding which came out of a study we did recently in Namibia. We did a sort of qualitative study around HIV-positive people's experiences of stigma. And one of the findings which came out was that all the participants in the study were, before being diagnosed, themselves stigmatizers. And the suggestion of that finding is that the reason why we feel internal stigma so powerfully is because overnight we go from being stigmatizers to being the stigmatized. I would just like to get your thoughts on that.
Anybody care to respond? Okay, why don't we take all the questions and we'll close the question and answer after we hear from the remaining three people, and then we'll allow the panel to respond to all the questions or comments.
Hi, my name is Krista Lauer. I work with AIDS Project Los Angeles. Thank you very much for this panel. I think it's an excellent component of this entire conference. And I was just wondering, there was some mention of particularly stigmatized communities in a structural way. So MSM, IDU, and commercial sex workers, particularly given that in certain countries in the world, these are actually criminalized identities. And I was wondering, sometimes the work that we do sort of falls into the public health realm, and needing to address things structurally, particularly decriminalization, sometimes kind of falls out of the boundaries that we have as public health organizations. And I was wondering what kind of ideas you had about linking into other organizations or a potential way forward, whether that's funding not just for destigmatization, but for advocacy as well, which has the same kind of M&E problems, of course. It's not nice quantitative outcomes, but I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Thanks. Can we have the next question, please?
Yeah, my name is Hasina. I'm from AIDS Legal Network in South Africa. I want just to thank some of the speakers for their action points. I can take that back to my country. My question is to Judge Cameron. If our attitudes of prejudice, rejection, discrimination, and stigma in communities send people into hiding and prevents people from accessing services, disclosing their HIV status, is it then not us, the society, without discrimination, rejection, and violations, that should be the challenge or the focus of our programs in order to create an enabling social environment of respect for rights acceptance and support where one can feel free to test, access, prevention and treatment services. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And our final question.
Hi, my name is Jorge Soler. I'm coming from the Latin American Health Institute in Boston, Massachusetts. My question is, so far at this conference, I've been to several talks now where sex work and MSM, for example, is labeled as HIV high-risk behavior. You know, I personally think to call someone's occupation or someone's, a man's desire for another man, for that to be labeled as a high-risk behavior is itself stigmatizing. Mm-hmm. And as a gay man, I actually find that very offensive. And so I'm wondering how we deal with that, considering that's coming actually from us, from the activists and the providers and people who are at this conference.
Okay, thank you. So we had one comment, one specific question for Edwin, and we had two general questions that I think any of the panelists could offer to answer. So why don't we take the one specific question for Edwin first.
Thank you very much. Rosina from South Africa. I want to thank you for your question. I think we all agree that the major problem with stigma is external stigma, because it's stigma that manifests itself in a disabling and unenabling environment. The difficulty that we're finding in South Africa, and we cannot close our eyes to it, is that there are people who are in perfectly enabled environments. The people like in Pam Pickens' organization who knew that there are drugs available, who knew that Pam and her staff and fellow colleagues would support them, who knew that her sister, who was a nurse in an HIV setting, would support her, who still were too fearful, too scared to take the HIV test and to receive treatment. So we've got to find what part internal stigma plays. I have no doubt that external stigma plays a huge role in these unnecessary, isolated, lonely, vulnerable deaths. But we also have to understand what part internal stigma plays when those external forces find an ally within the person at risk of HIV. So I'm adding to our agenda. I'm not detracting from what we've got to do with external stigma.
Thank you. So we had two other questions. One of them had to do with the importance of collaborating with other organizations in addressing stigma. And the second one had to do with the role of language in contributing to stigmatizing specific key populations vulnerable for HIV.
Go ahead. I do agree that there's a need for more collaboration. But I would really want to take you back to what Mariam said. It's the local response. A lot of innovative programs are there that challenges stigma on a daily basis within the community. But we do not know, you know, like how, don't have any tools to measure whether that affects, so that we can replicate that kind of models and then, you know, scale it up. And that's very important. In terms of the collaboration, yes, we need more donors to put in, invest in this, you know, in addressing and reducing the stigma and discrimination. We need to work with human rights groups, and we need to promote human rights, among the key population groups who are marginalized groups. But I think I just want to say something about the society should be challenged. Who are the society? We are the people. We are the one who are holding all these prejudices. And on different levels, I think it's important to challenge ourselves, and we need to be challenged. And this kind of terminologies of high-risk behaviors, yes, I do. Like, you know, when I started, I was diagnosed HIV positive, and I don't belong to that high-risk population. You know, often how it's been public health experts have defined it's, you know, women who are, you know, like, you know, most of the women, been infected or from their, you know, through their husbands. So I don't qualify that high risk, but I still, you know, I'm categorized as a low risk. So, you know, there is a stigma that has been created through this kind of technology, terminologies. I think that's definitely, I think we all must agree to that. And including myself, I feel that why do we, you know, need to, you know, segregate and have this kind of technology, which is, I think everybody is, at risk. So how do we address this? But public health experts say that, you know, in order to, you know, we have little money and we have to focus on this. From that perspective, how do we challenge it? There is no, you know, straightforward one single answer to address this. You know, that's the issue that everybody is grappling with.
Okay. Any of the other panelists like to respond to either of those questions before we wrap things up?
And just say quickly, thank you to David from Namibia for bringing up that point that oftentimes it's the stigmatizers who then become stigmatized, and what does that mean? I think we have to think a little bit about that, but I know there's also a study out of South Africa that talks about how people who hold highly stigmatizing attitudes are also less likely to recognize their own risks. So that's another way that stigma is impeding our efforts in this epidemic. And if we can reduce stigma more generally in the community, then that would become less of a problem. And I think it goes to this discussion of creating both the external and internal. And one of the things, just in general, from all the comments and also from Christina, who talked about as we're delivering public health, how do we deal with these structural issues? I think there are small things, not small, large things we can do within our own context, even if it's just simply addressing the three things that I had talked about in terms of creating awareness, addressing fear, and sort of the values that are driving some of this. And then that will feed, hopefully, into some of the structural changes. Just to say, we all have a role to play, no matter where we are.
Thanks. Edwin, did you want to add? Final comment.
Thank you very much, Paul. I asked Paul if there was another minute just to make the following point. I take the point about stigmatizing language, and we've got to avoid it for the reason that the questioner commenter gave. But I want to give you a last point that we had in South Africa. We had a firestorm of a controversy because it was discovered that the National Blood Transfusion Service, which is a non-profit which provides free blood to hospital services, was preferring white donors above black donors. The Minister of Health, whose name is Mantu Chabalala Msimangu, who has been infamous for her erroneous approach on many aspects of AIDS, then denounced the blood service for stigmatizing black people, for insulting them, because the prevalence was higher. Well, that itself was stigmatizing, and I've had fights with my friends in the gay community as well, because some blood services ask people who are actively having sex between men to disable themselves as donors. We're dealing with the prevalence of a virus that isn't inherently stigmatized. We stigmatize it by calling people who observe the prevalence and the higher prevalences in certain groups, like men who have sex with men, or the non-Caucasian community of South Africa. Those people are the stigmatizers.
Okay. It's very hard to sum up such a session as this one, and I won't try. But I would like to just close by, first of all, thanking all our panelists for their incredibly powerful presentations and bringing out so many of the different facets of this issue. Second of all, I'd like to just say that three things come to mind. One is that what I've heard from this panel is something that we all have to keep in mind, which is that this is an incredibly dynamic epidemic. It is changing over time in terms of the realities that people face at the ground level with their dealing with HIV themselves, the social realities, the political realities. And it calls us all to the challenge of constantly thinking and rethinking the human rights protection issues involved. In the old days, when there was no treatment and there was incredibly heavy stigma and discrimination, we built human rights protections around what Edwin said, which was enabling people through confidentiality and informed consent to have very clear control over how they would avoid the negative aspects of their status becoming known and the hopelessness of their status becoming known in light of no treatment. But of course, now we are in a world of treatment. We're in a world of government commitment to universal access to treatment. And so we have to probably rethink the human rights protections. Here we're now, the primary human right is the right to life. And how do we enable people to overcome the internal and external stigma that will protect their right to life? So this is I'm just highlighting that our challenge is constantly to rethink where we are, what do people need today in human rights protection. Secondly, I'd like to say that at the very beginning of this conference, we had Julio Frank talking about the three pillars of Mexican health reform, which were prevention, treatment, and protection from discrimination. We had Angela Pinto talking about the Brazilian program and its tripod, which involved also human rights as well as prevention, treatment, care, and support. Why have we bought a universal access, which is built on three pillars only, prevention, treatment, care, and support, with leaving off the fourth pillar of non-discrimination? Non-discrimination against people living with HIV, against women, and against marginalized groups. It's time to realize that we cannot continue this way. And I say it should be the fourth pillar because the governments have, in the Declaration of Commitment 2001 and the Political Declaration 2006, have promised to put in place programs to protect human rights, to protect people from stigma and discrimination. And yet, there is no programmatic sense of obligation with regard to these programs in terms of governments. So we have to make it the fourth pillar of universal access to have that programmatic obligation. And that brings us to, Miriam has very clearly outlined many of the reasons why we're not moving on this. Lack of awareness of the knowledge of knowledge and tools that exist, lack of persuasion that they are effective. But I'd like to throw out a third possibility, which is that governments, donors, international organizations, those in control of the funding, have their own stigma and discrimination. We ourselves are obviously not overcoming the stigma and discrimination that prevents us providing the resources that will actually open up these issues. Because what we're really talking about here are programs that are going to change societies, that are challenging the very essence of inequity and power imbalances in our societies. And it's very hard for governments to ask for such programs. So we're in a conundrum here because we want national responses to HIV to be nationally driven and owned, and yet we're asking governments to confront the very issues that they've been unwilling to confront for many decades. So I'll leave it with the last third point, which is that we have to generate demand for these programs. And that is up to us to do that. And there, I would like to see us try to work together to really build a social movement around demand for these programs so that we see them put in place as integral parts of national AIDS responses, fully funded, taken to scale, and making the difference that it's high time they make the difference. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us. Thank you so much.